Ugandan Justice Sabutendi, Julia Sabutendi. So these two individuals had followed politics, whereas the rest of the world's justices indicated that they have to follow principle. And I think that is also a bit of a triumph, that the Palestinian cause has become the litmus test for the international system. The effectiveness of the international system is a different question completely. But those figures that you've just mentioned, 15 to 2, 16 to 1, especially on the issue I found particularly shocking, was to hold accountable those that have been involved in incitement. Even Barak then voted for this, which meant that individuals like Benjamin Netanyahu, Yoav Gallant, the defense minister, Itamar Ben-Gvir, these individuals would have to be brought to account before a court of law. This is incredible.
All right, that's all the time we have for tonight's show. Allow me to thank my guests, attorney, activist, and political analyst Zakir Ahmad Maya, joining us from Johannesburg. And thanks to podcaster and journalist Esha Krishnaswamy, joining us from St. Petersburg. And a special thanks to you for staying with us on tonight's Spotlight.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. And now we enlighten you with Ayah 35 to 37 of Surah Ali Imran, recited by Shahriyar Parhizgar.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Dhurriyatan ba'dhuha min ba'dhin wallahu samiyun 'alim. إذ قالت امرأة عمران رب إني نذرت لك ما في بطني محررا فتقبل مني إنك أنت السميع العليم فلما وضعتها قالت رب إني وضعتها أنثى والله أعلم بما وضعت وليس الذكر كالأنثى وإني سميتها مريم وإني أعيذها بك وذريتها من الشيطان الرجيم فتقبلها ربها بقبول حسن وأنبتها نباتا حسنا وكفلها زكريا كلما دخل عليها زكريا المحراب وجد عندها رزقا قال يا مريم أنى لك هذا قالت هو من عند الله إن الله يرزق من يشاء بغير حساب
In the name of Allah, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful. When the wife of Imran said, My Lord, dedicate to you what is in my belly in consecration, accept it from me. Indeed, you are the All-Hearing, the All-Knowing. And when she bore her, she said, My Lord, I have borne a female child, and Allah knew better what she had borne. And the female is not like the male. I've named it Mary, and I commend her and her offspring to your care against evil of the outcast Satan. Thereupon her Lord accepted her with a gracious acceptance and made her grow up in a worthy fashion, and he charged Zechariah with her care. Whenever Zechariah visited her in the sanctuary, he would find provision with her. He said, O Mary, from where does this come for you? She said, It comes from Allah. Allah provides whomever He wishes without any reckoning.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
On the 114th day of the U.S.-Israel genocidal war in Gaza, the occupation forces persist in their aggressive campaign against Palestinians. The U.S. Secretary General urges governments to sustain contributions to UNRWA, highlighting the critical support needed for nearly 2 million civilians in the besieged Gaza Strip. And in a significant scientific achievement, Iran successfully launches 3 domestically manufactured satellites into orbit.
Well, welcome to the studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us.
There's no end in sight to the Israeli genocide in Gaza, as the regime's warplanes and artillery keep pounding the strip, with the focal point of the attacks now being the southern parts of the besieged territory. According to the Gaza Health Ministry, at least 183 people have been killed and hundreds more injured in Israeli strikes in a matter of 24 hours. 28 people lost their lives in the southern city of Khan Yunis alone. Israel is also pushing ahead with its indiscriminate strikes on the critical infrastructure, including healthcare facilities, schools, refugee camps, and even UN-run shelters. Doctors Without Borders say that Gaza no longer has a functioning healthcare system. Several hospitals in Khan Yunis remain under Israeli siege, despite warnings that many patients are at risk of losing lives. A doctor at Nasser Hospital describes the catastrophic situation there.
We have a major shortage of medical staff. We have less than 10% of hospital staff that are working throughout the war. The majority of injured people coming to the hospital are those displaced in schools and residential areas. Medical equipment in the hospitals is almost non-existent, of course. The simplest things in the hospital, such as painkillers and anesthesia tools, are not available. We are trying our best to deal with patients that arrive, and we are trying to keep them alive. We are not trying to treat them as we were doing before. We are just trying to keep them alive.
Several international aid agencies, including the UN, have time and again highlighted the humanitarian crisis in Gaza amid relentless Israeli bombing and shelling. The regime has, however, defied calls for a ceasefire, with several UN resolutions vetoed by Israel's key backer, the U.S. Since the start of the Israeli onslaught in early October, nearly 26,300 Palestinians have been killed, majority of them women and children. Meanwhile, the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says it has ambushed Israeli forces in central Gaza, killing and injuring several of them. The regime has so far confirmed 220 fatalities among its troops on the ground in Gaza. Earlier, we spoke to our correspondent in the Gaza Strip, Moti Abu Musaba, about the latest developments there. He has said the Israeli regime has intensified its attacks on Khan Yunis, targeting areas near the hospitals, as well as people who were waiting for aid.
The Israeli warplanes once again targeted the Palestinian civilians who were gathering near Al-Kuwait roundabout, waiting for the humanitarian relief. The Israeli occupation, as the last time, attacked them once again and killed at least three Palestinian civilians, in addition to dozens of the Palestinian injuries. On the other hand, Khan Yunis city till this moment is under heavy bombardment and continuous airstrikes, particularly the western parts of Khan Yunis city, the surrounding areas of Al Amal Hospital and the surrounding areas of Nasser Medical Complex. It was reported that at least a Palestinian civilians from the Palestinian evacuees taking shelter inside Al Amal Hospital was killed after the Israeli occupation forces shot at the hospital. And on the other hand, the Palestinian resistance is still fighting back. It was reported that Al-Qassam brigades and Saraya al-Quds have repeatedly targeted the Israeli tanks in those areas, in those battle zones. And in the meantime, the Palestinian resistance as well continued targeting the surrounding areas of the surrounding occupied territories in Gaza's envelope with different and multiple barrages of the missiles launched from Gaza cities. When it comes to the weather conditions, as for these moments, as we speak right now, the weather conditions are still catastrophic for the Palestinian people, knowing that the vast majority of the people in Gaza are living inside small tents, which cannot be taken shelter by the people in order to endure this kind of unprecedented situation.
The UN chief has called on the Western governments that have suspended funding for UN's Agency for Palestinian Refugees to at least guarantee the continuity of its operations. Antonio Guterres said that 2 million civilians in Gaza depend on critical aid from UNRWA for daily survival. He added that the agency's current funding will not allow it to meet all requirements to support them in February. The UNRWA chief has also slammed the aid cuts as shocking. Several countries, including the U.S. and the U.K., have suspended donations to UNRWA following Israeli allegations that some of the agency's staff were involved in Hamas' October 7 operation. The Palestinian resistance movement has called on the UN and other international organizations not to cave into Israeli threats and blackmail. The Israeli military has launched a fresh incursion into the city of Jenin in the occupied West Bank. Details from the operation are sketchy, but there are reports that the regime has deployed special forces and snipers near the Jenin refugee camp. The reports say the resistance fighters have engaged the intruding forces in armed clashes in Al-Hadaf neighborhood of the city. The Israeli military has launched dozens of deadly raids into Jenin since the regime began its onslaught on the Gaza Strip on October 7. That is part of a wider campaign of raids in the West Bank that has killed over 370 and injured 4,300 others. Our correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kandil, earlier joined us with more details about the Israeli raid on the Jenin refugee camp.
News coming from the refugee camp revealed that the Palestinians in the refugee camp discovered the undercover unit in the Al-Hadaf neighborhood in Jenin refugee camp. And this means that Israeli forces were there and they raided the refugee camp of Jenin and the city of Jenin. The clashes are taking place and the operation is still going on. Why? In the first place, the Israeli undercover unit raided the Jenin refugee camp. It is still unknown. The Israeli military didn't issue any statements yet, but the operation is still going on, and all the entrances to the refugee camp had been closed, where Israeli forces are stationing at the entrances to the Jenin refugee camp, as well as in the city of Jenin. Elsewhere in the occupied West Bank, Israeli forces had raided the city of Nablus and the village of Beita. In Nablus, at least 5 Palestinians had been detained. Elsewhere in the occupied West Bank, the Israeli forces had raided Qabatia as well in Jenin, and clashes had erupted between Palestinian fighters and the Israeli forces. In the village of Ashyuch in Al-Khalil, Israeli forces have stormed the village of Ashyuch, and at least 5 Palestinians had been detained there, where the Israeli forces stormed Palestinians' homes and destroyed the belongings of the Palestinians. In the Betonia village near Ramallah, Israeli forces had arrested 2 brothers there. And in Qalqibi, a number of Palestinians had been detained, including 1 woman.
The military wing of the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has released new footage of its attacks on Israeli forces in the Gaza Strip. In the latest operations, Al-Assam said that it targeted an Israeli tank and a troop carrier with rocket-propelled grenades west of Khan Yunis. The Al-Quds Brigades, the military wing of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad, said it attacked Israeli military vehicles around Khan Yunis as well. Al-Quds also fired rockets and mortars targeting Israeli forces in the Al-Maghazi camp. The group has fired missiles at several Israeli towns, including Sderot as well. Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement says that it has used a new tactical missile in its latest operations against Israel's military sites. Footage released by the movement shows Falak-1 missiles fired at Israel's Ma'ale Golani barracks on Friday. The new projectile has a range of 10 kilometers and carries a highly explosive warhead weighing 50 kilograms. Falak-1 missiles have a caliber of 240 millimeters. Hezbollah has also used another new weapon in its operations against the regime. It fired a top-attack anti-tank guided missile in an assault on an Israeli military outpost. The movement released a video depicting the missile's launch, its rapid ascent, and its trajectory toward the outpost on a cliffside along Lebanon's southern border. Hezbollah has been attacking Israeli military sites since October 7. On Saturday, it staged 7 more anti-Israel operations. In one of them, Hezbollah used Falak-1 missiles to hit a secret command center in the Zabdin barracks in the Israeli-occupied Sheba Farms. A Beirut correspondent, Mariam Saleh, says that Hezbollah had a pretty busy day on Saturday as it carried out several operations against the IOF, targeting Israeli soldiers and military bases.
Well, it was a pretty busy day today for the Lebanese resistance. They had several operations against Israeli posts, the most significant of which was the one where they targeted the Zabdin barracks in the occupied Sheba Farms using the Falak-1. Now, this is just a rocket that was debuted just yesterday by Hezbollah's resistance since the beginning of the confrontations. This is the first time that they uncover the use of Falak-1, which is, of course, something that was developed by Iran's aerospace industries organization. And it is, of course, known to have a range of 10 kilometers and a 50-kilogram warhead. So therefore, that use in itself is very significant. And they understand that the Israelis have said that this is something that would allow Hezbollah to hit their targets precisely on a longer range, and in addition to inflict more heavy casualties for the Israelis when it comes to against their soldiers or the barracks itself. And the fact that Hezbollah has also been able to know and detect the exact whereabouts of this secret headquarters, as they said, is also in itself very significant when it comes to the intelligence war between Hezbollah and Israel.
Iran has launched 3 homemade satellites into orbit as the country moves full steam ahead with its space program. Satellite Mahda, along with 2 nano satellites, Kahan 2 and Hatef 1, were sent into outer space on Simorgh 1 satellite carrier. The satellites were injected into an elliptical orbit with a minimum altitude of 450 kilometers and a maximum of 1,100. The most prominent achievement of this launch was the multiple injection operation, which was successfully carried out. It is the first time that Iranian space experts have launched three domestically developed satellites into orbit simultaneously. Iran has made major breakthroughs in the space sector by developing and launching numerous satellites. Pro-Palestine rallies continue unabated around the globe, some of them leading to violent clashes as security forces try to disperse protesters.
Human rights should be respected because it's a matter of humanity. They speak a lot about numbers and Hamas, and they compare this to a war. But this is not a war. It's an extermination. Palestinian people there have stones and nothing else. While they are being bombed as if it was raining, they are murdering an entire population, and it must be impeded.
The fact that when this all began, giving aid to Palestine, there were only four states that said no. And now we're over 100 days into the genocide, and we still have states that are afraid to call it that as it is. Everyone's afraid to make an enemy out of Israel and, above all, out of the U.S.
Hundreds of pro-Palestine protesters gathered in the Italian cities of Rome and Milan on Saturday, defying a ban by authorities. Demonstrators clashed with police who blocked the streets and tightened security measures. The Greek capital city of Athens saw thousands of protesters marching against the continuation of the U.S.-Israeli genocide in Gaza. Protesters held banners and chanted "Free Gaza" as they marched. In the Spanish capital, thousands of people marched in solidarity with Palestinians in Gaza, demanding an immediate ceasefire. They waved Palestinian flags and chanted pro-Palestinian slogans. Meanwhile, dozens of people demonstrated in support of Palestine outside of the federal courthouse in the U.S. city of Oakland as a case against the country's top official was being heard.
To submit charges against the executive branch of the government, particularly the President Joe Biden, his Secretary of State, and his Secretary of Defense for the fact that they have the authority and they have the power to not only to prevent the genocide from happening, but also they are complicit in continuation of it, and they are have the authority to stop it, to end it immediately.
We told our story, we told the court, we told the judge and everybody that could listen that we are descendants of refugees, of people who were forcibly expelled from their country. And then we proceeded to talk about the current Nakba that we are witnessing today.
Protesters waved Palestinian flags and held placards reading "Free Palestine." American demonstrators also demanded a ceasefire in Gaza, holding a list with the names of those killed in the besieged territory. Elsewhere in the U.S., protesters gathered outside of the home of the Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, in Virginia, to express their anger at the country's support for Israel. The U.S. has been providing military support for Israel throughout its onslaught on Gaza. Washington has also vetoed the U.S. Security Council resolutions that called on the regime to end its aggression. Thousands of Israeli protesters have rallied in Tel Aviv, demanding the resignation of the regime's cabinet and an end to its onslaught on the Gaza Strip. Israeli mounted forces attack protesters and clash with them after they tried to block traffic. Footage from the scene shows protesters trying to push back the mounted forces. Witnesses say a number of protesters were arrested violently. Protesters demanded an immediate ceasefire in Gaza and the release of captives held by the territory's resistance groups. During the past weeks, Israelis have used every weekend to take to the streets in their thousands to mount pressure on the regime's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. They slam him for ignoring their pleas to prioritize the release of captives. The military base housing U.S. forces in Deep Rock has once again come under attack amid simmering anti-American sentiments across the region. The Islamic Resistance in Iraq said in a statement that it launched a drone strike targeting the Ain al-Assad military base. There have been no immediate reports of casualties. The resistance has carried out dozens of such strikes over the past weeks in solidarity with the people of Gaza. The group slams Washington's support for the Israeli regime. Iraq and the U.S. have held the first round of talks on the future of American and other foreign troops in the country. The office of Prime Minister Mohammed Shia al-Sudani said the Iraqi premier presided over the meeting focused on ending the mission of international coalition. Earlier this week, the two countries agreed to start talks on the future of the U.S.-led military alliance in Iraq with the aim of setting a timetable for a phased withdrawal of troops. The U.S. has had a continuous presence in Iraq since its 2003 invasion. U.S. combat forces left in 2011, but thousands of troops returned in 2014 under the pretext of fighting Daesh. The latest round of talks comes at a time of heightened tensions. Iraqi resistance groups have been targeting U.S. forces almost on a daily basis since October, after Israel launched its genocidal war in Gaza. And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
Supplication on Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure. From wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to thee, addressing myself to thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to you for the hope of your rewards. So, bless Muhammad, the best of thy creation, the summoner to thy truth. Exalt me with thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely, thou art the all-forgiving, the all-compassionate.
The real gulf in British politics is not between Tory and Labour, it's between a hegemonic political class at Westminster and a decent majority that supports an immediate ceasefire in the Gaza Strip. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay with us. This is the second and final part of this article from the Middle East Eye. The Middle East Eye says, if Labour leader Keir Starmer was doing the job of opposition leader, he would have mocked David Cameron's poorly briefed claim to Sky News' Trevor Phillips on 14th of January that there was no evidence of Israeli genocidal intent in Gaza. As David Cameron ought to have known, and Trevor Phillips failed to point out, the 84-page document presented by South Africa to the International Criminal Court, ICC, at The Hague provides abundant evidence of Israeli genocidal intent. Had Keir Starmer been doing his job, he would have asked probing questions about Britain's bombing campaign against Yemen. Instead, the Labour leader gave his immediate backing to the attack, breaking the promise he made 4 years ago that he would insist on a Commons vote before committing Britain to war. Keir Starmer rejected the claims that he ditched that pledge. Recently, Labour leader Keir Starmer spoke about Labour Party's decision to drop its commitment to a Palestinian state. We should not make too much of this intervention. Labour quietly decided on the new policy last autumn. But as far as we can determine, this is the first time that Keir Starmer has articulated the new position in public. Starmer misleadingly framed the change as a break with Jeremy Corbyn's policy. In fact, it was Ed Miliband who threw the Labour Party behind the Palestinian state, and it was his policy that was being repudiated. There are, however, serious questions to be asked about the timing of the Keir Starmer intervention. Why now, 3 months into the war, and in the wake of over 25,000 Palestinian deaths in Gaza? Keir Starmer's timing is especially odd at a moment when Benjamin Netanyahu is making it clear that he will not tolerate a two-state solution. It was telling that the Labour leader chose to speak on the subject at an event hosted by the Jewish Labour Movement. This was a partisan venture, I cannot understand why Starmer did not choose a neutral space, for instance, the Chatham House think tank, to sound off on Palestine. To make matters even worse, understand that Keir Starmer did not consult Hossam Zumlot, head of the Palestinian mission in London, in advance. This snub proves that, under a Starmer premiership, there is no possibility Palestinians could trust Britain to play as an intermediary, let alone arbitration, role in any peace talks designed to bring about a solution to the Middle East conflict. However clumsy and partisan his execution was, Keir Starmer did achieve what appears to be the core aim of his leadership when it comes to the Middle East. He aligned Labour's policy with the Conservative government. Both main political parties now agree that British support for a Palestinian state should come as part of a peace process negotiations, rather than an objective to be pursued in its own right. In effect, this position gives Israel something very close to a veto. We have sometimes heard it said that the House of Commons is at its best when government and opposition agree. These cross-party alliances are often a bad sign. Two specially relevant and terrible examples come to mind. The first is the Iraq War. Tory leader Ian Duncan Smith threw his weight behind the Prime Minister Tony Blair in the run-up to the invasion, making far more effort to align himself with Tony Blair than ask testing questions about legality and war objectives. Just like Keir Starmer in today's Middle East crisis, Ian Duncan Smith gave unquestioning support and asked no questions. The war was an unmitigated disaster. The second is David Cameron's Libyan intervention 13 years ago, fully supported by both major political parties, and another calamity. Keir Starmer's handling of the escalating crisis in the Middle East has been a disaster for the Labour Party and for Britain, though doubtless gratifying for Benjamin Netanyahu. As the Israeli army has pounded the Gaza Strip with one of the most sustained air assaults in world history, Labour leader Keir Starmer has stuck to his uncritical pro-Israel position. He started out by throwing the weight of the Labour Party behind Israeli plans for the collective punishment of the Palestinian people. He's gone public on Labour's change of policy on support for a Palestinian state. He blandly accepted the widening of the conflict to the Red Sea, and he completely failed in the most basic task of an opposition leader, namely to hold the government of the day to account. As a result, the two largest British political parties are today aligned in support of Israel's war on Gaza, in defiance of majority British opinion, in denial about Israeli atrocities, and oblivious to the genocidal language used by the most senior Israeli politicians. Meanwhile, the International Court of Justice, the ICJ, ponders whether to accept South Africa's demand that the court should issue a suspension order against Israel's military operation in Gaza on the ground that it is committing genocide. If the court rules in South Africa's favour, then Rishi Sunak, as well as US President Joe Biden, will be wide open to charge that they are aiding and abetting genocide in Gaza. And so will Labour's Keir Starmer.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
The history of the land of Palestine.
Part 4.
At midnight on October 23, 2012, a building in Yarmouk on the outskirts of Khartoum, the capital of Sudan, suddenly explodes. Evidence suggests that an airstrike took place involving 5 aircraft. As a result of the airstrike, the building is destroyed and the equipment sustains serious damage. The next day, it becomes clear the planes belong to Israel and they had targeted a specific location. It's also claimed the mentioned building was a weapons factory. The Israelis claim factory's products were being sent to Gaza in Palestine. Ehud Barak, the then Israeli war minister, is questioned about this and responds that there is nothing specific to say which can be interpreted as an acceptance of responsibility for the attack. It is never clear who the source of the information was or how the location of the factory was figured out. However, whatever the case, it indicates Israel has good connections in Sudan. The relationship with Sudan was part of Israel's doctrine. The periphery doctrine, geopolitically, it was necessary for Israel to establish relations with other countries, to infiltrate them, to open an escape route for itself, and to gain access to resources and infrastructure. Sudanese forces had helped Egypt in previous wars, and if anything happened in Sudan, this support would be cut off. Egypt was losing a major ally, and Israel was infiltrating Islamic countries to reduce support for Palestine. Israel's history of presence in Sudan dates back many years, with initial connections forming in the 1950s through the Jewish community. Then, through political parties advocating for independence, they claimed to defend the liberation of Africa from Arab colonization. But after the Six-Day War in 1967, Israel's presence in Sudan became a necessity. In 1969, a group of Mossad agents clandestinely entered South Sudan. Their goal was to organize insurgents in the south. Prior to the mission, the final coordination takes place. You have to come to this vast desert to save the Jews. You have to live here, try to be natural, be careful, even saying one wrong sentence is dangerous. It ruins the work. If the insurgents in the south were organized, they would enter into war with the Sudanese army. In this way, it would prevent the deployment of Sudanese forces to the Suez Canal to support Egyptian forces in a potential war with Israel. Sometime later, through the Mossad, military supplies are sent. The flames of war are ignited so that Sudan is excluded from the circle of cooperation with Egypt to confront Israel. When South Sudan declares independence, the threat of Sudan to Israel diminishes. However, in these events, South Sudan does not achieve any specific results and only becomes a pawn of Israel. South Sudan participates in regional wars and conflicts and turns into a corridor of Israel's arms supply. For example, a rifle called the Micro Galil is exported in large quantities from Israel to Sudan. The Micro Galil were sold to Uganda in 2007. They are even used in the 2013 massacre in Juba. Years later, Sudan requests loans in exchange for normalizing relations with Israel. $1.2 billion in food shipments, $2 billion in financial aid, 25-year loans, and economic assistance. But not from Israel, rather from its allies. Because Israel was not inclined to generosity. In addition to Sudan, other African countries also played an important role in the puzzle of Israel's policies. Among them, Ethiopia had a favorable position and was considered an important target. Ethiopia, this landlocked country, had a unique feature in addition to its Jewish population. It possessed highlands and suitable mountains, the source of the region's waters, and was considered a waterway to other countries. Another characteristic of Ethiopia was its proximity to Sudan, and from there, to Egypt. From Israel's perspective, Egypt was considered Israel's immediate enemy. However, this was not enough for Israel. Egypt had to be within Israel's grasp. The Sinai Desert and the islands were protected by the Egyptians themselves, posing no threat to Israel. Israel's shipping was not facing any problems. But the most important issue was water. Water and the Nile River. The Nile River was the main source of life for many Egyptians and held great importance. The lack or scarcity of water would have created a security crisis for Egypt. Egypt's population is projected to reach 160 million by the year 2050. In the event of a water cutoff, over 2 million farmers would be directly affected. Israel had been after looting Egypt's water resources since the time of Herzl. When it became clear that the transfer of Nile water would come with difficulties, Israel sought to steal water from the source. Since 1946, America has been studying the construction of a dam in Ethiopia. The implementation of such plans would fulfill Israel's desires and increase Israel's influence in Africa. Initially, Israel carries out agricultural, medical, and public programs. Then it turns to military matters and trains special forces in Ethiopia. It then engages in arms trade while simultaneously spying on Muslims and Arabs. Later on, Jews are transferred from Ethiopia to Israel. Israel achieves its long-standing desires. In the 1990s, Israel expands its relations and targets other industries in Ethiopia. Consequently, Ethiopia becomes a pawn for Israel and a constant threat to Egypt. Water, this vital fluid, becomes so important that it turns into a significant issue during then-Egyptian President Anwar Sadat's visit to the occupied Al-Quds. During this trip, the Peace Canal Plan is proposed to transfer Nile water to Israel. However, this plan faces opposition from the Egyptian people. In the 1992 negotiations, the Nile water once again becomes Israel's primary concern. Israel's policy becomes entangled with water. Israel does not have enough water. If someone seeks peace, they should not question transferring water to Israeli settlements. For this reason, Israel's efforts to steal from the water resources of neighboring countries intensify. In July 2016, Benjamin Netanyahu expresses his most important desire in the Ethiopian parliament. "We support Ethiopian technologies to utilize its water resources." Netanyahu's words reflected Israel's policies in Ethiopia and Africa. Shortly after, newspapers reported the construction of a large tunnel to transfer Nile water to the occupied territories. In 2019, Israel expressed its willingness to take over the management of Ethiopia's water resources. During its presence in African countries, Israel presented a positive and benevolent image of itself, while its actual face was military operations, killings, conflicts, and even airstrikes in various regions. In 1985, the headquarters of the Palestine Liberation Organization in Tunisia was subjected to an airstrike. At least 56 Palestinians and 15 Tunisians were killed, and around 100 others were injured. A Tunisian boy was torn to pieces nearby. The airstrike by Israel was carried out to put an end to the activities of the Palestinian fighters, as Palestinians had transferred their headquarters to Tunisia after being expelled from Lebanon. The United Nations Security Council condemned the attack on Tunisian soil. It was later revealed an American named Jonathan Pollard had provided information about the Palestinians to Israel. Jonathan Pollard had transferred documents to the Israeli embassy in Washington that were considered sensitive and confidential. The documents contained evidence of military activities of various countries. Although Jonathan Pollard is later arrested and imprisoned, Israel continues to use Pollard's information for the assassination of Palestinian commanders, including the famous Khalil al-Wazir, known as Abu Jihad. He was a member of the Fatah movement, a politician, and a theorist. He was assassinated in 1988. Years after the Tunis incident and the assassination of Abu Jihad, Jonathan Pollard is released from prison and heads to Israel. He receives his passport from Benjamin Netanyahu at the foot of the airplane stairs and expresses happiness at returning home after 35 years. On the day of Pollard's show-off at the airport, another display of Israel was taking place in another corner of the world. An Israeli company had won a major tender in East Asia. This company was supposed to provide espionage and tracking services to the government of Myanmar. Israel's connections and interactions with East Asia and a country like Myanmar, where the Rohingya Muslims were being massacred, were very strange and unimaginable. However, this was considered part of Israel's global policy. Israel infiltrated tense regions and fueled conflicts. It communicated with specific organizations and individuals, supported them, empowered them, and then used them to implement its policies. Sudan, Ethiopia, Iraq, Kurdistan, Azerbaijan Republic, and even Myanmar were part of Israel's regular plans. The persecution of Muslims in Myanmar began in 2016. Thousands of Muslims were killed, many disappeared, and ultimately over a million people were forced to migrate in difficult conditions. Shortly after, Israel's complicated relationship with Myanmar was exposed. The military of Myanmar was in contact with Israel, and they regularly traveled to and from Israel. These trips resulted in military and commercial contracts. The Myanmar military became the primary buyer of Israeli weapons in the region and used Israeli surveillance equipment to monitor and arrest dissidents. In addition to Myanmar, Israel's footprint was tracked in many events in other countries. Indonesia was the founder of the Non-Aligned Movement, which supported the Palestinian cause. However, Indonesia later experienced coups and anti-coups. Political tensions in Indonesia were the result of foreign activities. Indonesia leaned towards the West, communists were persecuted, and many people were killed. After the end of the coup government in Indonesia, the issue of Palestine once again gained attention and support. Years later, it was decided that the conference of this movement would be held in Ramallah in the occupied West Bank. However, Israel did not allow the holding of this movement in Palestine. Israel had become a refuge for European Jews and was pushing Jews out of Europe, a move that was welcomed by Europeans. Since its formation and with the approval of the United States, Israel's technical capabilities improved. Israel engaged in espionage and successfully used American technology to seek revenge for the perpetrators of the Munich operation in the 1970s and the assassination of Palestinian and Lebanese fighters, as well as others. Israel, which had risen from fire and blood, sought to expand with fire and blood. For this reason, it participated in various conflicts and beat the drums of war.
We're going another strike on that.
He watched his workplace of 11 years vanish in.
Israel forged documents and continued to intervene in regional countries by misusing the mechanisms of international organizations.
The president's support for Israel's security, for its legitimate right to defend itself, and its people is fundamental and will never waver.
Later, Netanyahu tweeted that he had spoken with Blinken by phone. I thanked him for American support for Israel's right to self-defense, a right that the Secretary of State repeated in our conversation.
In the 1980s, although Arabs were considered enemies of Israel, Israel turned its enmity towards one country, the Islamic Republic of Iran. Israel used every opportunity to portray Iran negatively in the media and international forums. It spoke ill of Iran, made accusations, and tried to isolate the country and prevent it from accessing its rights and privileges through international organizations. However, it is Israel that conspires against Iran and continues to attack individuals and various Iranian organizations. The history of Israel includes the assassination and killing of scientists and elites by Israeli extremists. Anyone and any movement deemed dangerous by them will face a similar fate. Israel's actions in the region were rooted in the support of the United States and Britain. Their support strengthened Israel, and Zionists, through their connections, gained access to new, complex, and dangerous weapons, threatening everyone. Therefore, when Moshe Dayan spoke of Israel's military power, no one knew exactly what he actually meant.
I think we are strong enough to take care of ourselves, and if need, we shall be even stronger. We are modern people, good science and technology.
On October 5, 1986, the Sunday Times of England published an article about Israel's nuclear activities. The article contained photos and documents of Israel's nuclear efforts at the Dimona Nuclear Center.
It's not a chemical plant.
It was said that an Israeli whistleblower had exposed this information. The article was published after negotiations with the Israeli embassy, and only a small portion of the documents was released. Israel had a nuclear bomb. Despite the publication of Israel's nuclear news, Western countries did not protest against Israel. Neither did the United Nations, nor even the International Atomic Energy Agency, raise any complaints. Israel's nuclear activities continued in silence. Years later, it became clear that Israel's nuclear waste had been buried in various Palestinian areas. It seemed that the Zionists had turned to war and enmity against the concept of life. the extremism of the Jews, which had been ongoing for centuries, manifested itself in a new form in the 20th century, in the form of Israel. A small, troublesome demon in the Middle East region.
Iran lied. Big time. After signing the nuclear deal in 2015, Iran intensified its efforts to hide its secret nuclear files.
In the limelight.
The homeless population in America has reached a record high, according to an analysis from the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. Over 650,000 Americans were homeless on a single night last January. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. New York Post has covered this story and tells us more. The homeless veteran population is not seeing much of a decline. That's according to a new report from the Department of Veteran Affairs.